and welcome to the Triathlon Coach Podcast. My name's Simon Ward and I'm your host for this weekly show where my goal is to share practical, usable advice from the best athletes, coaches and experts from the world of triathlon so that you can get the most from your training time and maximize your enjoyment of the triathlon lifestyle. If you don't already know me, I'm the founder of thetriathloncoach.com and the SWAT Inner Circle, and I've been a triathlon coach for over 20 years, working with absolute beginners right up to Olympic athletes and coaching them to race at distances from sprint through to Ironman. Reviews and ratings are the currency of podcasts, so if you enjoy today's conversation, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop into iTunes, Podbean or Stitcher and leave a rating and a review. And while you're there, please subscribe to our weekly episodes so that they can be downloaded straight into your phone or your iPad or wherever you choose to listen to them. And finally, to say thank you, I have a free gift for you. I've put together 25 of my top tips amassed from 30 years of racing and training and coaching in the sport. All you have to do is email triathlonsuccess to beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she'll send it right out to you. Okay, now it's time to crack on with today's guest. Well, hello, we're listeners. Welcome back to another edition of the Triathlon Coach Swatcast. This is Simon Ward here, your host for this weekly episode. And today we have one of the legends of triathlon, triathlon coaching, that is. His name is Mr. Joe Friel. Welcome to the show, Joe.
All right, Simon. Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to get you on. Now, for listeners who've been locked in a cupboard for the last few years, they may not be aware of your books. I first found out about you through the Cyclist Training Bible and the Triathletes Training Bible, which I think you've rewritten at least the Triathletes Training Bible, haven't you, recently?
Actually, both of them.
Okay. But the book that I really want to talk about, Joe, and there is an awful lot of stuff we could discuss, the book really want to talk about is this one that you wrote most recently, I think, unless I've been living in a cupboard myself and not paying attention, is this Fast After 50, How to Race Strong for the Rest of Your Life.
Right. So that's it.
That's it. So firstly then, Joe, let me ask you, what was your inspiration behind writing this book?
Aging. I was about to turn 70. This is a few years ago now. And I remember that I'd written a book back in the late 90s, about 1997 or so, called Cycling Past 50. And in that book, it really was just my opinion for the entire book because there wasn't any research on the topic then. So I decided, okay, I've got a big birthday coming up here. I think what I'll do is I'll check the research again, see what's happened since I looked at this stuff, 20 years ago. And I found that there was a gigantic amount of research all of a sudden on aging athletes over the age of 50 and even later in life. And so I began to read it, and I was reading one research study a day, and this went on for months. And I started writing blogs about it, what I was learning, and so many people showed interest in it that I decided to write a book about the topic. And so that's where the book came from.
Where do you think that upsurge in research came from then? Is it just that as athletes were getting older, there was interest from the researchers, or was there something else behind it?
Yeah, baby boomers are just now hitting 70. They're about what's like 1945, I think, was the start of the baby boomers, and that group it just started becoming large enough that research was meaningful. Up until that point, there weren't enough old people to really, old people involved in sport to know what the data meant. The sample was too small. So now the sample had become quite big. And so consequently, lots of research was being done on athletes after the age of 50.
Okay. So that was your inspiration. So what was your intention and purpose behind the book?
My purpose was to see if I could figure out what was going to happen to me. I didn't really write it for anybody else. I just wrote it to figure out what I could expect to happen in the coming years, and what I should be doing in my training to keep things going the direction I want them to go. And so, really, it was very personal. I wasn't writing a book to help anybody. I was writing a book to help me, and so many people showed an interest in it, I decided to write it down into a book. And so it became, it's been selling very well. So apparently a lot of people have the same concerns that I have.
Yeah, well, I'm one of them, Joe. You know, I'm a few years behind you now, but 55, and I'm starting to see, well, maybe that's, maybe I've been refusing to see, but definitely starting to see some of the things you talk about. And those are the real things that are happening, you know, the things that I'm aware of, you know, because maybe I'm engaged in this like you are as a coach, and maybe I pay a bit more attention. But before we get to what really happens, let's talk about some of the myths, if you don't mind, of what people think is going to happen. And then maybe you can just spend a minute or two exploding those myths and putting them right.
Yeah, I think probably the biggest myth is that you can expect to go downhill very rapidly, and so don't even worry about it because you're just going to become a shadow of your former athletic self. That's probably, and I hear that all the time. I even hear it from younger athletes. You know, I hear people, and I go into a locker room someplace, and I'll hear somebody on the other side of the locker room saying, gosh, they just turned 35, and now they're so old, they're not sure they can do it anymore. And I'm thinking, gosh, you know, 35, you got to be kicking butt. You know, but I hear it all the way up. You go on people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. Everybody keeps repeating the same thing over and over, that it's beyond my capacity to do anything about this. It's out of my control. I just have to accept what it is and make the most of it. It's not that way at all. To explode that myth, and this is the major myth, really. You know, it really comes down to lifestyle. Basically, what happens is as we get older, a couple of things change. One is that we just become somewhat, more likely to feel sorry for ourselves, I guess is one way of saying it. We're just likely to decide we can't do that anymore because I am 55 years old or I'm 60 years old or whatever the number may be. We decide we can't do it anymore, so we quit doing it. And that doesn't happen immediately. It's not like it's all of a sudden we decide not to do something. It just kind of sneaks up on us very, very gradually in tiny, tiny little bites over the course of many months and even years. We come to the conclusion that we're beyond help, essentially. We can't do anything about it. We just have to accept it and go on with life until finally we die. And, you know, we are all going to die, but it doesn't have to be one of those things where you just slowly become a basically a weak skeleton and you can't do anything, but, you know, you can get out of the chair in the morning. It's hard to do. So, you know, that's the major myth I kept addressing all the way through the book, is that it doesn't have to be that way, that we can change things rather dramatically, but it's all within our personal control. It's not something that happens outside of us. It happens because we've made a decision to make it happen. So that's the bottom line of the book. It's just kind of like a, you know, my way of seeing the world, I suppose, based on what I know about aging.
Do you think that part of this belief that 35 is the tipping point where we start to go downhill is based on the general public and the recreational athletes' observations of what happens in professional sport? You see a lot of players that have been involved in professional sport for maybe 15, 20 years at that time, they do start to lose their speed, as we know. And at that point, they can no longer cut it against the 20-year-olds. And so they get retired, they get put on the bench, they're not on the starting lineup. And slowly they sort of, their career sort of is brought to an end. And because they've been so involved in sport, a lot of those athletes then don't do anything. So the next time we see them, they're overweight, you know, they're complaining about their sore knees. And so we believe that if that's what happens to professional athletes, it's going to happen to us.
Yeah. And early in the book, I cite a research study on that. There are very few longitudinal research studies. A longitudinal research study is one where they take the very same subjects and they study them today in some aspect of their life or lifestyle. And then they come back to them 10 years later and see what's changed. And they come back to them 20 years later and see what's changed and so forth. That's a longitudinal study. Those are very, very rare with obvious reasons. They take forever to finally get your paper into a publication. And so consequently, you don't see them very often. But early in the book, I cite such a study that was done, if I recall right, in the 1930s. With a group of American national and world-class runners who were really kicking butt you know, on the roads. And it followed them for the next 20 years, see what happened to them. And over that 20 years, they test them again, like in 10 years into it. What they found was that their lifestyles changed quite a bit. Some of the former national world-class runners stopped running. And what happened to them was rather dramatic. They had a gigantic loss of aerobic capacity, which is a good measure of your endurance fitness. They had a gigantic drop in that. And they gained weight. And there were a number of other issues that went in that changed about their physical makeup. Then they looked at the runners who had changed from running competitively to just doing basically jogging. They became recreational runners, didn't race anymore, didn't do anything fast, just went out and did long, slow distance stuff. Those runners lost a lot of VO2 max. Also, they had a lot of things change about their physical makeup, not nearly as dramatic as those who did nothing. And then there was the third group, which kept on doing races. They kept on doing high intensity training. And at 10 years after their testing, they still had essentially the same VO2 max. They were still very competitive. They had not experienced all the changes that took place physically, physiologically, that the other two groups experienced. So that was the first one. One of the first studies I bring up is to show that things don't have to be this way. It has to do with how you see yourself and how you see what you're doing and what you want to do. Those who kept on doing high intensity training stayed at a really high level of fitness and performance for many, many years after their careers, their racing careers were over. So, and then that's not the only study. I cited several throughout the book. That was just the first one I brought up.
You mentioned high intensity training there. Do you think that's another myth that as we get older, we shouldn't do that sort of work because it's bad for us? You know, we're going to have a heart attack, we're going to get injured. So we need to do, you talked about the runners there that continue to run, but did long, slow distance. And I hear a lot of athletes saying, you know, I don't do intervals anymore. Is that another myth?
You're exactly right. That's that creeping change that takes place in our lives. It doesn't happen all of a sudden. We wake up one day and say, I think I'm done doing intervals now. It's one of those things that just kind of comes on very, very gradually over time. You know, I get an injury and it's after having done intervals the day before, running intervals the day before, something like that. And that certainly makes sense. But the problem wasn't the fact that the athlete did high intensity training, interval training. It's the way they did the interval training that's the problem. I tell athletes, for example, in the book, that one of the most valuable things you can do is high intensity training as you get older. If you quit doing it, I can guarantee you the downside is gigantic. If you keep doing it, the downside is rather small compared with, you know, a great gigantic loss of aerobic capacity, et cetera. So there's a great benefit to doing it. The problem is that athletes don't know how to do intervals. If I tell an athlete in a book, which I've done many times, that one of the ultimate workouts they should do is something like, let's take running for a minute, something like 5 times 3 minutes at a very fast pace. I won't get into the details of what the intensity is, but it's very high, much, much higher than running a 5K, much higher than that. So they do 5 times 3 minutes at that very high intensity with 1.5 minute recoveries after each one. If I tell them that's the ultimate workout and they decide, okay, I think I'm going to do intervals, tomorrow they go out and they do that workout. They don't allow themselves to very gradually and slowly adapt to the workout. They think they can just go out and do it immediately. And obviously they're going to get hurt. They're going to be sore. And there's all kinds of downsides. Potentially they could have a heart attack under that kind of condition, depending on their, you know, a lot of things about their physiology, but they don't know how to do it. They just don't understand the idea of the workout dose. How big should the workout dose be? Should I just do the ultimate all of a sudden out of the clear blue, or should I gradually build up to it over the course of several weeks, maybe even months, which is what most athletes are unwilling to do. They don't have the patience. It takes a great deal of patience to get older. And unfortunately, athletes don't have that patience in our society.
I was thinking that what you were going to say there, Joe, is if you tell them the ultimate prescription is 5 times 3, they'll go out and do 6 times 3 because, you know, if 5 times 3 is the ultimate, 6 times 3 has got to be better, surely.
Or 5 times 5.
Or 5 times 5, yeah. But whatever it is, if that's the ultimate, then I'll just add my own little spin on it and make it even more of an ultimate.
You're right.
Okay, then. So high intensity training, the rapid downhill. Were there any other myths that really stood out for you?
Yeah. We're going to lose muscle mass. We're just going to wither up because we look at old people around us and they don't have much muscle. They're just kind of withered. You know, they got their muscle mass is so small that they can't even hold their posture. You know, they kind of slump. And then they get into their 70s, maybe even their 80s. They got to have a walker because they're so weak. And so they think this just happens to everybody. It doesn't happen to everybody. It happens because over time we don't do things that stress the body. We quit doing those things. We become lazy, basically. And again, it doesn't happen suddenly. It happens in tiny little morsels over the course of years. But eventually we decide, man, we're just going to lose muscle mass. And it doesn't have to be that way. We can maintain that muscle mass. In fact, there have been several studies done where people in nursing homes in their 80s and even their 90s increase their muscle mass. When researchers put them on a strength building program and they compare them with 20-year-olds put in on a strength building program, they find that their rate of improvement is the same for both the 20-year-olds and the 80 and 90-year-olds. So we can still make dramatic changes in our muscular makeup, and that's a big part of what we're all about. Without muscle, there really isn't much left. We're just a walking skeleton that can barely move. So muscle mass is critical, and we've got to maintain it.
I think that subject is one we should return to later on, Joe, because strength training and the lifting of weights is definitely something that endurance athletes find challenging, both from a time perspective when they're trying to fit in all of their other endurance activities, but also getting the head around how that's actually going to help their performance. So I think we may need to return to that one later on when we talk about some things that athletes could be doing. So any more significant myths then? Because those seem like the ones that I hear all the time as well.
Yeah, one more I'd toss in on top of that is that we're going to get fat. Because everybody you see who is, you know, up there in years has got a big belly. And so consequently, that's just going to happen to me too. So the first time I realize I've got a big belly, all of a sudden, I didn't realize until now that that's when I look myself in the mirror or in a photo and I see I've got a belly. I think, well, that's just the way it is. You know, that's what happens to you when you get older. And it's really not what happens to you when you get older. It's again, a lifestyle issue. All this keeps coming back to lifestyle. We make changes in our lifestyles because of things we think are going to happen, these myths you're referring to. And lo and behold, we're just simply making the myth happen by changing our lifestyles because we think it's going to happen. That doesn't have to happen. But we do need to be very cautious of what we eat as we get older. We can't just continue to eat like we did when we were 25 years old. We're much smarter now about nutrition. And we need to take that information that we now have, which we didn't have when we were 25 years old, and apply it to who we are now, because things do happen physiologically with the body. There are going to be changes in our metabolisms, for example. Part of that, however, is because we cut back on the activity. And so when you cut back on activity, metabolism slows back and you become more likely to gain body fat. But if you stay active, you can help keep that a bit under control, not totally under control, but you can help keep that under control just because activity does use calories and does help to keep you somewhat leaner.
I get you on all this then. We hear this stuff, and so then we become the architects of our own downfall, really. And then when it happens to us, we look in the mirror and say, hey, look, I told you this was going to happen. It has happened.
There it is.
Okay, right. So those are the myths, and we've started to explode those and show why they are really just myths, and it's not the inevitable. Let's just before we come up with some ideas that some of the listeners can use, perhaps we could talk about what some of the realities of aging are, because we know that there are going to be certain things that happen, and we have to recognize these in order to be able to make strategies to counter them. So can we just talk about what we will experience and perhaps how we can identify when that starts to happen?
Yeah, let's start with one that's a positive instead of a negative. Let's start with wisdom. As we get older, we should be becoming more wise about many things in the world, one of which is ourselves and who we are. And because of that, I think we can become much better self-coached athletes. Still probably the best way to deal with this whole problem is to hire a coach who understands working with older athletes and how to deal with them. But if we can become wiser about who we are and what we're doing, not rush into things like we did when we were much younger and think that's the way you're just supposed to do it because I'm an athlete. Therefore, I can go out and do, you know, 6 times 3 minutes instead of 5 times 3 minutes or even 1 times 30 seconds to start off. You know, so I think we need to think of ourselves in terms of being wiser about what's going on and get some contemplation to our physical makeup and why we are the way we are and who we'd like to be 10 years from now. Who would we like to be 10 years from now? One of my role models is a gentleman who's in his 80s now. I've known him. His name is Bob. I've known Bob since he was around 70. He's now in his mid-80s. He still does Ironman triathlons. He has a hard time finishing anymore. It's become a challenge for him. Wind is a real challenge for him, especially Kona. But he keeps on training, keeps on qualifying, keeps on going to Kona every chance he gets. You know, tremendous athlete. He's still lean. He's still fit. He's still young mentally. He doesn't have that old person's way of dealing with the world. He sees the world as a young person does. Meaning that he understands that he's responsible for himself. Nobody else is. His doctor is not responsible for him. He's responsible for himself. So that's the way he sees the world. And he's one of the reasons that I live my life the way I do, because I've seen Bob deal with his many challenges that have come up over his life and how he's dealt with them. And the guy is just a fantastic role model. I think having role models like that who are older than we are is very beneficial. So I think that's a starting point.
Do you make a point there about wisdom, and I'd written under a list of benefits of getting older. The first one I wrote actually was wisdom. So I think we're on the same page there, but equally, if I use myself as an example here, Joe, I mentioned that I'm 55, but in my head, I still think I'm 35. So in some ways, are masters athletes their own worst enemy in that they still think, and you know, you talked about Bob there. He still thinks like he's a bit younger. Do you think that the optimism that allows us to feel like we're 35 and we can still do those things still means that we will try to do things that we did at 35, and that can be a downfall?
Yeah, all we have to do, what we have to change is the numbers. There is certainly going to be a loss of aerobic capacity as we get older. I've never found any study that shows that we can stop that from happening. There's going to be a decline. I've watched mine go down over the last, 50 years, something like that. And it's not a pretty sight to see it happening, but I know it's happening because there are things taking place in my physiology that I can't change. There is a limit to what we can do physiologically as we get older. And I just have to live within those limits and do the best job I can of keeping the loss of aerobic capacity very, very slow instead of allowing it to accelerate. So, but that really all just comes down to a mindset. You know, I've got to be willing to accept the fact that there are going to be changes, but they should not be dramatic changes that happen over a short period of a couple of years or a few years. They should happen over a decade or decades before we see things like this show up for us. So really, again, just comes down to how we see ourselves and how we see the world we live in.
Yeah, I guess there's a point where we also, where we have to stop trying to get fitter and faster, except that process is happening, like you said, the reduction of your aerobic capacity, and focus on minimizing the decline.
Exactly right.
Is that a better strategy and mindset to be adopting, do you think?
It is, yeah. We are going to experience a loss of performance over years. That's unquestionable. That is going to happen. But with the study I talked about, the longitudinal study at the very start of our conversation, some of those runners went 10 years without seeing a change in their aerobic capacities, and they were at probably the highest point of their lives when they were in their 20s as world-class, national-class runners. But they were able to maintain that because of their attitudes, especially when it came to the idea of training. And they're continuing to do high intensity training. That played a big role in it. So we're gonna lose performance. That can't be stopped. What we can do is slow the rate at which it changes, which is what that study shows.
And I suppose then one thing I notice is that when I was younger, I would sort of try and compare myself to younger athletes and guys that were a little bit older than me. And I think I've learned in the last few years to only be worried about the guys that are around me in my age group, not to worry about the guys that I still swim with a group where most of the athletes in my lane are at least 10 years younger than me, and I'm still comparing myself to them. But really, I should be looking at the guys that are my age and seeing how I compare to those guys, because they're my ultimate competition if I'm in a race, aren't they? Silly in one that has age groups. Well,
exactly right. Or even from a lot of us, just even comparing ourselves to ourselves. How am I today compared with the person I was a year ago or 2 years ago or 5 years ago, whatever the number may be. So, you know, really comes down to, again, how we see the world and who we are within that world.
You talked about loss of aerobic capacity. Do you see that mobility declines with age, you know, joint tightness and stiffness, perhaps coming with injury and scar tissue that's built up over the years?
Yeah, to some extent, yes, probably that's going to happen. But then again, a large part of what we experience along those lines is because we quit doing some of the things that we were doing when we were younger. Going back to the idea of runners again. Runners, when they were younger, probably spent more time doing things like hill workouts, fast intervals, things that stressed our bodies and to its limits many times. And we did that almost gleefully because it was fun to do. But as we get older, we kind of realize, oh, this is kind of hard work and maybe I shouldn't be doing this. And they start building excuses. And next thing you know, they've gone several years without doing anything like that at all. And so consequently, things like range of motion is lost. You know, without some stressful workouts, we don't get any better. Stress is what makes us the athletes we are. If we try to reduce the stress to the lowest number possible, we're simply going to lose our performance and our fitness extremely fast. We've got to have stress in our lives. Stress is good for us. Stress is beneficial. There are two types of stress. One is called distress, which we don't want. That's stress that causes injury. That's stress that causes overtraining. And then there's something called eustress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S. Eustress is good stress. Good stress is what makes us more fit, makes us stronger, makes us better people. It's kind of the old saying, you know, that which doesn't kill me makes me stronger. It's kind of that thought, although there's some problems with that thought, but that's the general idea. So we've got to welcome stress and we've got to be willing to experience it and not try to avoid it all the time.
Another myth that we didn't talk about, Joe, but that I hear regularly is that as we get older, we sleep less or we need less sleep. Now, is that for sedentary people? And if you're an active person and you're maintaining your metabolic rate through you know, higher levels of activity, do older athletes still need to get the same amount of sleep, or does that decline for them as well?
Well, there seems to be a decline if we compare somebody's over the age of 50 with somebody who is a teenager, for example. So it depends on what we mean by more sleep or less sleep. A teenager needs a gigantic amount of sleep because their body is going through a tremendous number of changes as they mature, puberty and so forth. You know, the final stage of puberty require a great deal of sleep every night to be able to accomplish the changes that are taking place. And as we get older, of course, we don't have those same sorts of stresses that we need to deal with like the teenager does, but we still do need to be getting considerable amount of sleep. And I'm afraid in our society that we don't get nearly enough. I don't coach anymore, but when I was coaching, I always got athletes who had very high goals. They wanted to qualify for the Boston Marathon, or they wanted to finish, you know, Ironman Hawaii, or they wanted to be on the podium at a world championship or whatever it may be. I never got athletes who came to me and said, what I want to do is I want to finish a local 5K. I never got those athletes. I always got the ones with extremely high goals. What I used to tell those athletes with extremely high goals is that you can only have three things in your life with this goal. If you want to lower your goal, you can have more things in your life. But if you're going to have this goal, let's say qualify for Hawaii, you can only have three things in your life. You can have your family, you can have your career, and you can have training. If you have anything else, if you decide you want to become a member of the local city council, or you want to take up golf, or whatever it may be, you have just basically given the death knell to your high goal, because you just can't handle all of that. Because the first thing we do when we add more things to our lives is we cut back on sleep. You know, so I'm a triathlete. I've got to get up to make the morning group swim. I've got to be up by 4:30 and at the pool by 5. But I've got a family, you know, I've got kids, and I get the kids to bed at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night. Haven't had any time at all with my spouse today. Haven't watched television. Haven't read the newspaper. I've got to do anything. So I stay up for another 3 hours doing that. The next thing you know, it's 11 o'clock or it's 12 o'clock midnight, and I got to get up in 5 hours. And so I set an alarm, and I do get up and manage to roll out of bed and make it swim on time. But what I did was I just reduced the amount of fitness my body is going to redeem because of the hard workout I did the day before. So that's the bottom line I tell athletes is it comes down to your lifestyle. If you're not getting enough sleep, it's just because you got too many things in your life. How much is enough sleep? I would say the answer to that question is, if you didn't have an alarm clock, what time would you wake up? And then how many hours did you sleep? That's what your body needs every day. So, but unfortunately, we have to use this artificial means of waking up, alarm clocks, so we can make it places on time because we've got to fit more things into our lives every day. So that, you know, this sounds like like I'm preaching, but the bottom line is if you got too many things going on in your life, the first thing we give up is sleep. And if you give up sleep, you're just not going to be able to reap the benefits of training. It's going to be pretty much a waste of time.
Okay. That's a good one. I think it's always worth reinforcing the benefits of sleep, because my experience is probably the same as yours, Joe, that most people just don't get enough. I've been using one of these little sleep trackers called the Whoop. It's a little wristband. It measures my stress level, you know, my strain on my body throughout the day in training, as well as just moving around and walking. And it measures my heart rate and measures my heart rate variability. And then it puts all that into what it calls my daily load. And it has this little sleep coach app, and it gives me three options, whether I want to just get by, whether I want to perform, or whether I want to peak. And then it'll tell me that if I want to get up at 6 o'clock, to go to the pool, I need to be in bed by 9:30 in order to get the sleep I need to peak. And, you know, that's based on its artificial intelligence of learning what I need. And what shocked me was just how much sleep I need when I'm doing maybe 2 to 3 hours of training a day. And I definitely wasn't getting enough. I think it tells me, or it was telling me, that what I consider my normal sleep hours were just about giving me 75% of the sleep I needed. And it's hard work. Trying to find the time to sleep. It's hard work. It's not just
it is.
Results just aren't going to happen, are they? Especially if you want to go to Kona, you've got to work hard at everything, not just the training.
Exactly right. Well, that's a good device, because what it does is it acts like a coach. When I was somebody's coach, that's the sort of conversations I would have with them. You know, what's going on in your life? Let's talk about all the stress in your life. What's happening, and how can we make it work to your advantage rather than to your disadvantage? And that's what your device on your wrist is doing. So that's a good way of making you more aware. That's what it's all about.
Well, I mean, that will be something. I don't know if that comes with age, Joe, but you talk about being more aware. This and maybe that comes with wisdom, is mindfulness, you know, not just going through life and reacting, but actually thinking about what you're about to do, thinking about what effect it's going to have, thinking about if you did that set of 6 times 3 minutes instead of 5, how's that going to affect the sessions you do tomorrow?
Exactly right.
Okay. Anything else that we need to keep an eye out for happening as we get older then? What about changes in our metabolism? Or is that another myth that the metabolism slows down as we get older?
No, it does appear to slow down. It does appear to slow down. But I think it probably slows down physiologically less due to aging than it does because of changes in our lifestyles. Again, we're back to the same place. I keep hammering this point home that we tend to become our own worst enemies in terms of lifestyle. As you suggested a while ago, sometimes we just produce our own problems by making decisions that reinforce what we think the problem should be. And so I suspect it, it doesn't have to drop as fast as it may be dropping or changing, but it does appear to change from what I've read. I've not seen much on this, but there seems to be some indication in the research that there is a change in metabolism with age. Whether or not that's what the cause of that is, I really don't know. We're getting down to the nuts and bolts of physiology to discuss causes like that.
And what about our ability to process foods? Do you think that changes as we get older? Do you think our stomachs become more discerning or more choosy? And you know, when you're 18, you seem to, and into your mid 20s, you seem to be able to get away with eating anything. Yes. And as you get older, that's definitely not the case.
Yeah, you're right. I think that's a big part of it. You know, when you're late teens, early 20s, you can make all kinds of mistakes in your life. This being one, what you decide to eat. You can eat junk food all day long and you can still compete at a very high level. No problem at all. You can cut back on sleep and probably do quite well also. But as you get older, as you get over 50, for example, and older than that, all these little things begin to have a bigger impact on the type of person you're trying to become physiologically, physically, performance wise. All of these things have an impact on that. And so you need to be much more wise about what you eat. When you're 50 years old, 60 years old, 70 years old, you just can't eat junk food all day long and do away with sleep and still compete at a high level or even be able to do anything at a high level, even a moderately high level, like you did when you were young. So the world, our physiology does change, and we've got to change along with it.
I want to just touch on heart disease, Joe. You've probably read the book Haywire Heart by Leonard Sinn.
Yes.
And right. You probably know quite a few of the characters that are mentioned within that book who've developed heart problems. Many of them who are mentioned have been competing at a very high level. I mean, and there's several triathletes, isn't there? Dave Scott, Norman Stadler, Greg Welsh have all had heart problems, so there's probably more.
Yeah.
And I'm involved in a couple of studies that they're doing in the UK to try to explore more about older athletes that have had what they call extreme endurance histories, see whether it's lifestyle factors or training or genetic or something else. What are your particular thoughts about this issue?
Yeah, I've read The Haywire Heart, and it's a great book. And I know both of the authors, known them for years. And so it's revealing to read when they talk about it, because I know where they're coming from and where they've been, really good athletes, and yet they have these things happen to them. It seemed really outside the realm of what we would expect to happen. I recall back in the 1970s, there was a book that came out called The Complete Book of Running. And I've forgotten the author's name off the top of my head right now. It's not coming to me. But he wrote in the book that if you ran a marathon, you would not have to worry about ever having a heart disease or dying of heart disease. You're now immune from that. And lo and behold, something like 6 years later, he died of a heart attack while out on a run. Jim Fix, yes, thank you. I couldn't come up with the name. But that's just an extreme example of what we're talking about here, that being an athlete doesn't make us immune from especially genetics. We don't really know the reason why. I've got a good friend who has what's called AFib, atrial fibrillation. His heart will occasionally just flutter. It'll just do these weird things where beats at, extremely high rates irregularly while he's out on a workout. And he's had a couple of treatments for it now, and he seems to have it under control. Hopefully he does. But he's still somewhat worried about it, as I can imagine anybody would be. And that was what one of the authors of Haywire Heart had experienced also. And we don't know right now if there's something that goes on in endurance training that may promote that, or if it's just one of those genetic things that the person was going to experience anyway, whether or not they were an athlete. And so it just came to happen even though they were an athlete, and that being an athlete doesn't mean you're immune from things like that. Being an athlete doesn't make you immune from cancer. So why should we think it makes you immune from atrial fibrillation if it's, something that just some people seem to have. I think it's something like, from the research, 5% of the general population in the U.S. has atrial fibrillation. Is there any reason to believe that something less than 5% of people who are athletes should have atrial fibrillation? I don't know. But it raises a question. The question it raises is, does being an endurance athlete actually increase your risk of having AFib? That nobody knows the answer to right now. And that's one of the things they're looking at very closely. So it's a very interesting topic. I certainly don't have the answers, but it's the sort of thing that if you have experienced that, or you know somebody in your family who has, it's probably a good idea to be checked out for it and to kind of keep your eye on the situation.
There's a couple of points there. I read Jim Fix's book, and I read some stuff afterwards that suggested that he had heart disease when he started running, and so far from running being bad for him, which is a lot of the people who did, you know, thought that running was bad for you, use that as an opportunity to say, "Yeah, there you go, told you."
Yeah, you bet.
I think that running actually saved Jim Fix's life and gave him a few more years.
Could have. Yeah, that for me came at a particularly bad time, because I owned one of the first running stores in the world back just about the time Jim Fix died, just a couple of years before he died. I think it was around 82 or so when he died. I opened a running store in 1980. And so that was not really good for my business at that point when Jim Fix died, and made the headlines around the world that the guy who said you're immune from heart disease died of heart disease, even though he'd run several marathons. So very interesting topic.
The other thing about the atrial fibrillation and atrial flutter and the other things that go along with that, I've experienced several friends and athletes in the UK that have had that, and people I've worked with. And I suppose the flip side of that is that the exercise we do probably gives us a stronger heart, and so it allows our heart to survive that sort of event. Whereas somebody who didn't exercise perhaps might not have such a positive outcome. So it you definitely shouldn't be avoiding exercise either and being afraid of that.
I agree. We know there's lots of research that shows that exercise increases your life, your longitude, and also the quality of your life. So we know that happens. That's been shown over and over again in many, many studies. So quitting exercising because you're afraid that you might have something happen to your heart is kind of like the opposite of what you ought to be doing. I think it was, who was it? Here again, my mind is not working. George Sheehan used to be an author, wrote for Runner's World magazine. He's a physician. He said that, the old saying is, if you're going to take up exercise, you ought to see your doctor first. But he said, really what the saying should be is if you're not going to run, take up exercise, you should see your doctor first.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because doing something is far better than doing nothing.
Yeah. Okay, Joe, let's move on to giving our listeners something that they can do. So we've talked about the myths and we've exploded those. We've talked about the realities of what's going to happen. I'm going to ask you first, actually. You said you wrote this book when you were 70, and then you said that was a few years ago. So if you don't mind me asking, what age are you now?
I'm 75.
Okay, so you learned all these things, you read all these research papers, you decided to see what would happen to you. So how did the personal Joe Freer experiment go, and which things worked for you and which things didn't?
Well, I certainly have continued to do high-intensity interval training. I've been doing that really all my life since I was in high school. And so that hasn't changed at all. So I do, my interval sets, a couple of times a week, much as I have in the past. The numbers aren't nearly as nice the numbers as they used to be, but that's just part of what I've become used to, being 75 years old instead of 25 years old. Things are going to change like that. So I've certainly seen that happen. Numbers aren't as great as they used to be. But then there's stuff that, it's hard to really to nail things down and tell you exactly what's going on, because other things in your life change also. For everybody, things are always changing in our lifestyles, even when you get into your 70s. When I turned 70, the year I turned 70, the company that I helped to found a few years ago, Turning Peaks, decided to start sending me around the world doing presentations to coaches. And so I started being gone like 1 month, 1 week out of every month on average every year, and have been ever since then. And so basically I lost my training, lost 25% of my training. So that obviously had an impact on my performance and you know, all this stuff. So there are lots of things that go on in our lives. It's hard to narrow it all down just to, you know, doing one thing like, you know, your diet or the type of workouts you do or so forth, because you've got so many things you've got to accommodate and balance in your lifestyle. And so my numbers aren't nearly as good as they were before I started all the travel. Is that entirely because of the travel? I don't know, you know, because I can't separate these things out and tell you what's 25% that and 30% this. It's just the way it is. It's my life.
I guess that traveling as well, you know, I know you come over to UK, I know you go to Australia, so there'd be jet lag involved in that. And I guess that we've talked about recovery. So therefore, even though you're gone for a week, when you get back, there's another 2 or 3 days or more to add on to that, getting over the time zone changes where training isn't absorbed quite as well. So actually, it's probably more than 25% of your time is affected.
Yeah, I agree. I just got back from Australia, and it took me 3 days after I got back to finally sleep through the night. And that happened last night. Finally got, you know, a solid night of sleep. So it's just, again, part of the things that impact who I am, and I just live with them.
Were you always a big advocate of strength training when you were younger? And have you increased the amount of strength training you've done as you got older?
Yeah, when I was in high school, I can still recall being in the gymnasium at the start of the track and field season, and our head coach saying we shouldn't lift weights because it would make us bulky and we wouldn't be able to run fast anymore. But I didn't believe him. There was something about it. It didn't sound right to me. So I was lifting weights in high school. Nobody else was doing it on our team because the coach said don't do it. But I would sneak in, you know, in the off season to lift weights. When I got to college, the same thing. This is now the early 60s. And the same thing, we weren't encouraged to lift weights. And I was the only person in the weight room. It was a tiny little weight room. So it was a good thing I was the only one there. But none of the other athletes would lift weights. And that was in the 1960s. And so then the 1970s, I became a high school teacher and a track and field coach. And I was still lifting weights. And basically, I've been doing it all my life. My house has a gym built in, so I don't have to drive to the gym someplace, which becomes one of those things that keeps me from lifting weights. I just got my own gym right here. So, for example, this morning after breakfast, I went out and lifted weights in my gym. And it's just part of my life. I don't see it as being anything different than anything else in my life. It's like brushing my teeth. It's something I do every day.
One thing we've been talking about aging or older athletes here, but I still encounter resistance from older triathletes, male and female, who tell me that you know, weights aren't good for them, they'll get heavier, at the same time as they're complaining about losing power, and you know, they can't jump as high or they can't sprint like they used to do up the hills. And yet, to me, this loss of muscle mass, as you talked about, will happen with aging if you don't do anything about it. And so, you know, if we put the athlete title aside and take in performing human, one would encourage all people who are going to get older to be lifting weights just to enable them to continue with healthy human function. And then the athlete part comes after that.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Our ancestors, you know, existed because they had to do things that were stressful. They had to find a meal. They had to chase down animals. They had to forage for food and carry it. They had to move heavy objects, carry a deer after they had brought it down, or whatever it may be. But all these things were a part of living. They never thought about not doing these things. It's what they had to do to survive. But in our society, we don't have to do that to survive. We can sit in front of a computer, you know, for 8 hours every day and get paid to do that, and never do anything at all that's stressful for our muscles. So I think it is very beneficial for all people to be doing things that require use of muscle mass to overcome resistance. But if you look at an athlete, let's take a cyclist. You know, how much power you put out comes down to two things. How much force can you apply to the pedal and how fast can you turn the pedals? That's the two things that really make the power numbers that an athlete experiences. If you change either one of those things, you lose power. If you decrease either one without changing the other, you lose power. Cadence is probably not a big issue for most athletes, although some could probably work on that. But power is being able to drive the pedal down has a lot to do with how fast you go and how well you perform. Part of that is you can do many things to increase that power. One of those things, not the only thing, but one of those things is to lift weights. That helps to improve the power if you're doing the right exercises. And I don't want to go into all the details of that. But if you're doing the right exercises, you can build power and become a more effective cyclist, for example, on hills or even on flat terrain doing time trials or triathlons. So lifting weights is very beneficial and is part of what our ancestors had always done. They always had to overcome resistance. We can get by our entire lives without doing anything at all like that, but that doesn't mean we should. We should be living a life which still involves a lot of muscular stress.
In the same way that we talked about high-intensity training, we needn't be afraid either of lifting heavy weights. I think that's the key here also, to keep overcoming resistance is to be able to lift heavy weights. So that means not low weights and high reps, which people mistakenly think is going to benefit our triathlon performance, but doing deadlifts or squats or whatever without going into the details, you said, but not being afraid to lift something that's going to enable you just to do five or six repetitions.
Exactly. It's the sort of thing, it brings us back to the same conversation we started with. If I said do 5 times 3 minutes as the ultimate workout, you don't start out doing 5 times 3 minutes. You start at a much smaller number, like 2 times 30 seconds. And over the course of several weeks, if not months, you build up to doing 5 times 3 minutes. It's the same thing with the weight room. We don't, you know, if I tell somebody doing squats is beneficial and doing 5 or 6 reps is the ultimate for something like that, you don't start out by doing 5 or 6 reps with extremely heavy load in squats the first time you go in the gym. You do it very, very gradually over the course of weeks, if not months, before you're able to pull off the ultimate workout. So again, it comes down to you've got to be patient. You just can't expect these things to change overnight, and your body is going to break down if you force it to do things that it's not adapted to.
Okay, intervals. So we're going to keep doing the intervals. We're going to focus more on lifting weights, or if we've been doing that most of our life, we're going to continue to lift weights. We're not going to let the birthday card tell us that that's the time to slow down. Other things that we might want to consider, Joe, we talked a little bit about diet earlier.
Right.
Do we need to be more aware of with our nutrition, or do we just need to be more mindful of what we're putting in our mouth?
That's where it starts. If somebody wants to reduce their body weight, which a lot of people in our society do as they get older, the first thing they should do is not change so much the type of food, you know, carbohydrate, fat, protein, that sort of thing. They should just simply start cutting back on junk food, sugar primarily. Mm. We get way too much of it in our diet. We're sold sugar all day long. You know, you can't pick up a sports magazine without somebody trying to sell you sugar. There's going to be something in there about how great it is for you, and you've got to have it if you're going to be a good athlete and so forth. And I think sometimes we use athletics indirectly as a way of okaying eating sugar. You know, we see it, okay, if I go out for a workout today, that means I can have more dessert for supper tonight. Or I can use a sports drink full of sugar, even if I'm only doing a 30-minute workout. You know, it's not an excuse to eat sugar just because you exercise. There's a long, you have to do something that's fairly significant to require any sugar at all. Your diet will take care of almost, you know, 90% of people's workouts can be taken care of just with the diet they have, without worrying about things like sports drinks and gels and bars and all this stuff that we're sold anymore as athletes and told we have to be an athlete. It's not the case. You don't have to have all this stuff. It's rare that you do need it. Most athletes don't need it at all. So it really comes down to, you know, just being a little bit wiser about what we're eating and not seeing exercise as being an excuse to eat sugar.
Sounds like you and Phil Maffetone are on the same page of the book there, Joe.
We agree on a lot of things.
When we were talking about the high-intensity intervals, we talked a little bit about recovery. And I was actually at the Training Peaks conference in Boulder a couple of years ago. There was a lady speaking called Kathy Zawadzki, who specialized in working with older athletes. And she said that, like you, that there was nothing to be afraid of with doing high intensity intervals. But in order to maintain the quality of those, sometimes you needed to have different recovery periods, longer recovery periods between the reps to allow the body to restore and to get their quality, and that you needed to consider your recovery in between sessions. So do we need to be more mindful about our recovery as a whole and in our workouts as well?
Yes, we do. Both you mentioned both short-term and long-term. Short-term means within the workout, especially if somebody's not been doing intervals and they start back into it. They need to start off with something which gives them a relatively long recovery, longer perhaps than they did when they were much younger. And then over time, I think those recovery intervals can be reduced. But we need to start off with being a little bit more on the cautious side, just the same as I would not start off with having an athlete do 5 times 3 minutes with 1.5 minutes of recovery, which is the ultimate workout. I wouldn't have an athlete start off with, you know, 1.5 minute recoveries, even if they did only 2 of those intervals or 3 of them. It needs to be a little bit longer intervals, somewhat longer, maybe as long, instead of being 1.5 minutes long, maybe 3 minutes long between the intervals. But over time, I think those can come back down again as the athlete finds they're adapting and they're becoming more fit and able to handle the stress of the workout. Then they can begin to stress themselves in new ways. And one of those stresses is to reduce the amount of time between the work intervals. The other part of that is the long-term recovery. And yes, we probably do need more of that. And I've certainly found that as I've gotten older, that I can't do as many hard workouts back to back as I used to be able to do. When I was in college, my coach would have us in track and field. We would do basically the same workout every day, which was intervals. I called them intervals till you puke, because there wasn't any indication of how fast we should be going or anything else. You just run as hard as you can, and I'll tell you when to start the next one. And you'd eventually wind up, somebody starts throwing up after a while, and that usually marked the start of the beginning of the end of the workout when somebody started throwing up, because the coach would realize we're at our limits. So, that's not the way to do this. We need to kind of control things in our lives and do things that are reasonable. And part of that is just simply realizing that we can't start off doing what we did when we were 25 years old. We have to start off at a much lower level and work our ways back up to close to what we used to be doing.
In your book, I think there's a section from Ned Overend when he talks about training. He talks about high intensity training, actually, but later on in that little insert, he talks about how he can still do his 4-weekly cycle. It just takes him 8 weeks to get through it now because he needs more recovery in between the sessions.
That's right. Yeah, I've certainly found that to be the case too. So I started to say that I was doing 5 in college. I did 5 interval workouts in 5 days. In those days, you never worked out. You never trained on the weekends. That was a taboo. Even Roger Bannister, when he broke the 4-minute mile, never trained on the weekend. Everybody only trained Monday through Friday, and weekends were always days off from exercise. That may have been a good thing. I'm not sure, but that's the way we did it back then. And so I'd do intervals 5 days a week. Today, I couldn't possibly do those intervals 5 days a week. I could do one session, and I'd probably need at least 2 days off before I did the same session again. I couldn't come back 24 hours later and repeat it. But back then, I was able to do that.
What about volume? I mean, we talked about intervals and the importance of keeping those in, but one thing that the older athletes I know seem to favor is doing the long, slow distance stuff. Maybe this is in sort of resistance to keeping the high intensity in there, and they figure that's what they need. But in my mind, if they've been consistent with their training, they've built up a great base of endurance, which doesn't get wiped away, even if you have totally wiped away, even if you have a couple of years. So is there any need to keep returning to the endurance pot and renewing that? And should we be actually thinking about reducing the amount of volume we do a little bit to aid with our recovery?
Well, certainly as we age, we can expect the volume to decrease, again, just because of things I just mentioned, like not being able to do intervals 5 days a week. That's certainly going to change. And when we talk about, the training load is really just how much stress your body can handle. That's all it really is. The more stress you can handle, the more fit you are. And so what should happen over time is you know, over the course of the season, let's say, you should be able to build up the stress you can handle. You should be able to handle more stress by the end of the race season than you could at the start of the base period. That's just something we should expect to happen. And if you're doing things right, that's what does happen. And so we should expect that to happen. But we still, again, if we want to balance, come up with a balance between high intensity training and long, slow distance, as you mentioned, you know, these things are both good. There's not anything wrong with either one of them. It's just a matter of how much of each do we do. That's what the issue is all about here. This takes us back to this relatively new research that's been around since the early 2000s, started by Stephen Seiler on the 80-20 concept, the polarization of training, that, you know, a small percentage of your training, roughly 20%, is at anaerobic threshold or higher, you know, very high intensity training. And the biggest portion, something like 80%, is below your aerobic threshold, very, very easy workouts. And so that concept is what we're talking about here, and trying to get the balance right between these two. I'm afraid what happens as we get older, we move closer to 100% at aerobic threshold or lower, and closer to 0% of high intensity. When we were younger, it wasn't that way. There was a different balance between the two, and we need to not give up on high intensity training. It's still valuable to our fitness, our health, our longitudinal life, the quality of our life as we get older. All these things are all tied up in what we do with our lives, especially in training.
I've got a nice list developing here, Joe. I'll repeat some of those at the end. Well, I'll repeat them now, actually. Let's see if there's anything else you'd like to add to this list. So we're going to continue to focus on interval training. We're going to give lifting heavier weights more of a priority, or maintain that priority. We're going to be more mindful about what we eat. We're going to try to keep that sort of 90 or 80-20 principle in our training for as long as possible. We are going to focus a bit more on recovery and understanding that we need recovery. Would you like to add anything else to that before we finish?
Just to expand on the idea of recovery, this brings us back to sleep. And I'm afraid what's happening in endurance sports is we're forgetting about adaptation. Everything is becoming recovery. So we've got all these devices now to speed up our recovery. We've got, you know, the compression boots we can wear, hot and cold alternating baths. There's all kinds of stuff we've got available to us now to speed recovery, but those things have not been shown to speed adaptation. Adaptation is not the same as recovery. We've got to adapt. And the only time adaptation takes place is during sleep. Workouts do not create fitness. Workouts only create the potential for fitness. That fitness isn't realized until we get into deep sleep. That's when the growth hormones are released, and when the physiological changes take place throughout our bodies that we call fitness. And so the bottom line is, I would suggest people be less concerned with recovery and more concerned with adaptation. And that really means just get more sleep.
That's probably a good one to finish on. Seeing as it's 8:30 in the UK here, Joe, I should be thinking about my sleep very soon.
All right, I agree.
My little gadget will be telling me it's time to get into my pre-sleep routine very shortly. Listen, yeah. That's been great, Joe. And there's definitely some stuff that I'm going to personally take on board there. I'm definitely continuing to do the intervals and the strength training, and I'm trying to be more mindful about all those. But I think they're going to become more of a priority. And I think we have to use that key skill that we have learned over the years, which is the wisdom, trying to be wiser about what we do, rather than throwing all the mud at the wall and just hoping it sticks like we did when we were 20.
Agreed.
Okay. Right. Well, Joe, is there anything else that you would like to say to our listeners before we go? Any final bits of wisdom for them before we end?
Let me just throw out one last passing thought here. I recall in our conversation just now that a couple of years ago, there was a French cyclist who was 105 years old, who broke the world's record for 1 hour on the track. And he rode, I think it was something close to something like 20 kilometers per hour. I'm sorry, more than that, probably like 20, 25, 27 kilometers per hour. He rode something like that for an hour at 105 years of age. And he had improved his aerobic capacity over the course of training for that test or that race. He improved his aerobic capacity about 8% at age 105. That's where we need, the way we need to be seeing the world. If he can do it, I can do it. It's amazing what we can accomplish if we really put our minds to it.
That's a great way to finish, Joe. Thank you so much. Well, listeners, you have had over an hour there of one of the world's most well-known, credible, legendary coaches, Mr. Joe Friel. Joe, thank you very much for sharing your wisdom and your thoughts and your knowledge with us today.
Thanks, Simon.
Listeners, thank you as always for joining us. We'll be here next week. That was Joe Friel that you listened to. Please go out and buy that book. There was one final thought I had for you, Joe, right?
Okay.
In order to be faster at 50, is there an argument for saying that we need to start preparing for that when we're in our 30s and 40s? Because if we start, a bit like a pension, if you start putting money into your pension a couple of years before you need it, it's a bit too late. You need to start laying the foundations for that a lot earlier. Would the same go true for being fit and fast after 50?
Yeah, exactly. There's been several people who have written me emails and said they were in their 40s and they bought my book because they wanted to get a head start on being 50. And really the stuff in the book is not, you don't have to be 50 to do this stuff. You should be doing this stuff all the time anyway. You know, getting enough sleep, reducing sugar in your diet, lifting weights, doing high intensity training, 80-20 concept, all these things, we should all be doing these things. I just wanted to bring it into the scope of somebody's over the age of 50. So it's all ages.
Okay. So that final postscript then, even if you're listening to this and you're thinking, well, this isn't going to affect me for another 10 or 15 years, you can get a head start, just like some of Joe's email correspondence there. You can get a head start on those other people, put the foundations now, and you can still be going strong into your 50s and 60s, and maybe even when you're 105. So from Mr. Joe Friel, all the way from you in Boulder now, Joe, at the moment?
No, I'm in Sedona, Arizona.
Okay, so all the way from Arizona, and from myself, Simon Ward, your host on this weekly podcast, thank you very much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your week. That's a wrap for this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening to the conversation, and I hope you learned at least one thing. If this is the first time you've listened in, please go back and take a listen to some of our previous guests, and I can guarantee they will be just as good as the one you've just heard. If you've been a regular listener, then thank you for being a part of this journey with me so far. Finally, I'd like to take just a few seconds to tell you about my SWOT Inner Circle program. In the last few years, I spent an awful lot of time creating training programs and resources to help you train and race at whatever triathlon distance you choose, and for some of the events outside of triathlon like aquabike, duathlon and swimrun events. As a SWOT member, you get access to all of these plans for 12 months of the year. And on top of that, we provide guidance on strength and conditioning, nutrition, plus a whole host of other supportive activities which help you to train, recover and race better. We also have a really friendly Facebook community. It's an exclusive Facebook page for SWOT members only, and there are over 150 of them already. If you join, you'll be able to get access to that page and you'll be able to ask for help, and our members are all too happy to provide guidance and advice based on their experiences. I'll also be there to help you find solutions to your training problems, and all you have to do is tag me in the Facebook page in one of your posts, or you can book a 15-minute phone call should you need one. If you'd like more information, or if you're ready to press the button and join the SWOT Inner Circle, just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com and she will send you all of the details. So that's all for this week. Hopefully I'll see you again next week, same time, same place, with a different guest.